Hi, and welcome to a new episode of Ethics for a Changing World. Technology introduces a whole new set of considerations in so many different contexts, and today we're going to be talking about how a specific type of feminism is trying to respond to those challenges. I'm really excited to be joined by Dr. Emily Jones, who's a senior lecturer at Essex Law School, and among her research interests are gender, international law, and post-human theory. We're going to be talking about a specific type of feminism, which is called xenofeminism, and post-humanism, and how we can apply these terms together. And then what happens when we apply these concepts to broader problems with new technologies, especially autonomous weapon systems. If you like the episode, be sure to share it with friends and leave us a review, and subscribe as well wherever you're listening to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at EthicsTechPod or on Instagram at Ethics for a Changing World. Without further ado, on with the show. Hi, Emily. Thanks so much for joining us. Could you just start by telling us a little bit about your own work?
Hi. Yeah. Well, thanks, first of all, for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here. In terms of my work, I work across various different areas of international law. So I guess first and foremost, I'm an international lawyer, but I work across kind of practice and theory. So I'm interested in particular in kind of gender and international law, so feminist and queer approaches, and particularly kind of post-human theory and international law, which I think we're going to get into in a little bit. So I'll leave that more than kind of there, that big word. And then within those kind of fields at the moment, I'm looking in particular at the regulation of military technologies, so particularly autonomous weapon systems, human enhancement technologies. But I'm also really interested in the rights of nature in international law and how we can set global rights of nature standards in international law. So that's kind of what I'm doing at the moment. Yeah.
So you mentioned this term post-human. Could you just unpack for us a little bit what that means?
Yeah, that's a really important question. So I'm very glad that you did ask it. Post-human theory for me very much comes from gender studies as well. So very inspired by gender theory. But I define post-human theory in a very kind of critical way. So first of all, thinking about exclusionary humanism and the way that that has structured a lot of contemporary thought. So by this, I mean, you know, thinking about gender, about race, about class, about ableism, and trying to kind of deconstruct that central human figure, which we see predominantly within the law. But secondly, the other thing that post-humanism does is to think about anthropocentrism as well. So, you know, why do we always see the human figure as the central subject of thought? You know, how can we think about human connection to machines, but also bringing in the non-human, so the environment, non-human animals, etc. So I really see post-human theory as bringing those two things together, and that's the way that I use it.
And we have also talked a little bit about transhumanism on this show. Could you just, where's the difference between those two things?
Yeah, I mean, there are people that are using transhumanism in different ways at the moment, and there's kind of attempts to kind of reclaim it. But broadly, I would distinguish myself from transhumanism quite a lot. Transhumanism is this idea of wanting to transcend the limits of the human. So, you know, how can we kind of live forever, kind of beyond death, think about kind of different ways to use technology like that. And I guess for me, critical post-humanism is very different to that transhuman project, because transhumanism is still really centering the kind of white male Eurocentric subject, whereas critical post-humanism is seeking to kind of move beyond that subject itself. So I guess there's a difference in the kind of aim in that in the end, if that makes sense.
And a lot of your work focuses on a specific type of feminism, which is called xenofeminism. Could you just tell us, I mean, that sounds like a very cool word, but what does that mean?
Yeah, lots of complicated words, but they, I guess, make things sound more complicated than they need to. But I see xenofeminism, it's kind of another word for a particular group of people that wrote a manifesto called the Xenofeminist Manifesto a few years ago. I see this as part of the umbrella of post-human theory and of post-human feminism. So I see xenofeminism as coming under that. But xenofeminism, I mean, I would recommend you check out the manifesto because it's quite easy to read. It's on the internet and it's quite a nice website to flick through as well. But it broadly kind of looks at the ways in which technology can be reappropriated for feminist aims. So how can we think about designing technology in feminist ways, or kind of doing things like that? So a kind of example would be for example, there's this project called the Open Source Gender Codes Project, and it allows people to grow their own tobacco plants at home and to create therefore hormones to allow you to transition. So if you're a transgender person, you know, this allows you to kind of actually grow your own hormones at home and transition outside the medical apparatus, outside of the state. So there's a very kind of DIY element to xenofeminism as well. So that's kind of xenofeminism. Hopefully that kind of answers that question.
And then is there a flip side to that, which says that science and technology can be used in a way which kind of reinforces the oppressive structures, but they can also be used in a way which liberates people?
Yeah, definitely. And this is what a lot of my work on xenofeminism has also really done. So the Xenofeminist Manifesto and xenofeminism more broadly is pretty positive, as I said, about technology. But I'm an international lawyer, so, you know, I'm obviously very aware of kind of the structure of military technologies. And, you know, most of the technologies that we use in our everyday lives now were initially military technologies, sat-nav. You know, we see drones being used as cameras now, but we know that they were initially designed for the military. So there's definitely that darker side. And my work very much tries to kind of understand, well, how can we retain the kind of knowledge of that darker side, the fact that these technologies are very much complicit in militarism, in kind of capitalist structures as well, while also seeking to kind of promote more feminist futures. So that's kind of how I try and use xenofeminism. And there is, xenofeminism does touch on this a little bit in itself, but I think there's a kind of need to pay greater attention to those particular power dynamics.
And how then do you apply xenofeminism in the very, I guess, traditionally kind of macho, also problematic world of the military in that kind of context?
I mean, it's really difficult because the kind of feminist international legal literature on kind of disarmament, militarism and military technologies is very much anti-militarism. It comes from a kind of long history of pacifism. So, you know, we can look back to the kind of the work that the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom have done since 1915. It's really strong on disarmament, on focusing on that side of things, on promoting peace. And I guess that kind of contrasts with this other side, which is like, well, the xenofeminists, they're kind of saying, well, how can we reappropriate technology for feminist aims? And I think that there is a big tension there. So my work tries to kind of hold that together. And as an international lawyer, I think in many ways as well, it's part of my role is to kind of try and insert these ideas into the debates, into practice. So that's really important. So how can we think about kind of some of those feminist questions and bring disarmament into that debate, while also seeking to understand different ways of regulating these technologies and involving ourselves in that debate as well? So that's kind of how I see my role.
And then just more broadly then, how do we apply this feminist kind of post-human crossover in a way, like when we apply it to international law, what does that look like? What changes?
Yeah, so I think specifically thinking about technology, because that's what we've been talking about until now. So as I said, one of the things that I focus on in my work is the regulation of autonomous weapon systems. So what this kind of changes in some ways, so the debate around autonomous weapons has been kind of, should we ban them? You know, do we really want machines making these life death decisions? And post-human feminism kind of comes in and says, well, what about the kind of machine and human connection? So part of the problem with the debate around autonomous weapons is that the machine is always very much seen as the other to the human. So it's this autonomous thing and we need to control. So how can we think about meaningful human control over that entity? But a post-human feminist analysis kind of looks at, well, actually humans and machines are already making these life death decisions together. We could look at drone warfare for an example of that. You know, drone warfare is based on the collection of so much data that, you know, sure, of course, somebody is choosing to then fire a particular target. But if you have a file that's like enormous, that then says, you know, this person is probably a terrorist, you should probably conduct a drone strike on them. Well, actually, the machine in some ways is already making that decision. So the point there is well, if we're looking at, we're concerned about machines making life death decisions, well, actually, in some ways, they already are. And we need to challenge this humanist assumption that the human is already very distinct from the machine. So that's kind of how it inserts into that particular debate.
I was interested by what you said about this kind of focus on the human. Does that also apply to animals as well?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of international environmental law, it very much does. So obviously, I'm going to go back to international law because that's my field. But international environmental law as well, it's the body of law that we think of that is there to protect the environment, to protect animals. But it's very anthropocentric. It really, in the end, prioritizes human interests over all others. And we can see this, for example, by looking at the principle of sustainable development. This is a principle that is kind of the key thing that underlies international environmental law. It's kind of the Uber principle in some ways. But ultimately, sustainable development says, well, you know, you can actually extract resources. You can kind of use things in that very kind of object way. You know, you can extract things as long as it's sustainable, as long as it's not too much. And this is the kind of underlying principle that we see in terms of thinking about animals as well. There's a lot of really great kind of critical animal law studies, stuff that is coming out that is saying, you know, yeah, the animals do get treated very much as objects in the law. They're never seen as subjects. And we need to challenge that anthropocentric position.
And does all this kind of come back in the analysis to for want of a better word, kind of that misogynistic gender hierarchy kind of way of thinking about things? Like it all comes back to the same. We treat animals in a similar way to women were traditionally treated, and to some extent can be treated now still.
Yeah, very much so. I think that's a great way of thinking about it. In some ways, it's, you know, how can we challenge this exclusionary human subject? So as you mentioned, women actually were objects in the law and in England, for example, sort of many centuries ago. And, you know, in the present day, animals still very much are. The environment is very much still an object to be exploited. So, you know, how can we challenge these sort of exclusionary categories? And of course, race is really important here as well. You know, many kind of scholars that are bringing in post-humanism and Black studies or critical race theory together are kind of noticing and highlighting the fact that the exclusionary human subject is very, very much white. You know, people of colour have never had access to that in the same way. And the way that the law applies as well is very exclusionary in terms of that. So, yeah, it's really kind of making those links and trying to understand, well, who is the kind of non-human subject here? And that can be kind of the fact that women or queer people or people of colour are also less than human in some ways in the way that the law is set up. But it can also be thinking about non-human animals, the environment, and to some extent machines as well.
One of the kind of big names in technology and feminism, which some people might have heard of, is Donna Haraway, who wrote The Cyborg Manifesto, I think in the 80s. And she has this argument that we're all already cyborgs in the way that we interact with technology. Could you just explain that a little bit for us? What does she mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, Donna Haraway is brilliant. So I'm glad to bring her into the conversation. So yeah, as you mentioned, she wrote something called The Cyborg Manifesto in the 80s. And then she subsequently has updated it for kind of the more contemporary moment. But yeah, one of her main arguments, as you said, is that we're all already cyborgs. So we're already connected to technology. And we can really see this now. I mean, the way that we're all very much connected to our mobile phones, we're deeply, you know, we're talking right now over the internet. We're deeply connected to technology. And, you know, she notes that there are risks with this. So one of the things that I love about the Cyborg Manifesto is that she does say, you know, there are risks in terms of militarism and thinking about the way technology could be used for very nefarious things. But at the same time, she finds a lot of potential in that. So she talks about, you know, if women or people of colour, for example, have never had access to that exclusionary human subject of thought, of the law, etc. Well, maybe if the technology is challenging the boundaries of the human, we're all already cyborgs, we're not kind of just human in that sense anymore. Well, maybe there's a lot of potential in that because it could transform the way that we think about the subject full stop. So that's kind of the promise that she finds in the cyborg subject.
And do you think that, I mean, how do you think we bring out kind of the positive potential in that without the risks? We hear a lot about the issues with technology. Facial recognition is very bad at recognizing certain groups of people. There's a lot of issues that are being increasingly reported with technology, with the algorithms that are being trained, etc. this is a very broad question, but how do we bring out the positive aspects?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a broad question, but it's a really important one as well, because, yeah, as you said, we see kind of all of these technologies, you know, yeah, facial recognition software that can't recognize black faces, for example. I mean, that shows who made this technology and who it was trained on. We're seeing more and more work that is showing gender discrimination in technology. So how do we actually bring kind of feminist or kind of critical ideas into that? I mean, I think on the one hand, it's really important to actually have people that are thinking this way who are developing these technologies. And there's kind of important movements towards doing that. But it's difficult because technology is so much embedded in these kind of big corporations. So, you know, capitalism very much plays a big role here. So how can we think about kind of taking technology outside of the hands of those companies? And I think kind of movements towards open source software and kind of making things more open access is also another really interesting way that we can start to kind of almost democratize technology and the internet and have more people involved in making it and saying what it should do and developing it, etc. So I think that will be really important too.
Coming back to your own work on autonomous weapons, one thing you said which really struck me was this idea that kind of killing machines, if we can call them that, don't necessarily have to come from the state sector. It could also be developments that come from the private sector that are then used by the state, because obviously it goes both ways. It's not just that the US military develops the technology for sat-navs. It's also that someone else could develop that technology and then the military could then use it.
Yeah, I think this is increasingly important. I mean, we've long, you know, ultimately military, the developers of military technologies have always been private companies for the most part anyway. So we can kind of think of Raytheon and the big kind of big military tech companies. But this is kind of changing a little bit now in that we're starting to see more and more big tech companies that are developing technologies at a faster pace than the military sector. So originally we kind of, you know, all of the money would come from the military and these technologies would be developed there first and then used in civil use, as I mentioned at the start, you know, sat-nav, et cetera. But we're starting to see now, yeah, Silicon Valley is actually advancing so much that they are developing technologies that could then later have a military use. And I think that that's really concerning. I mean, we also see people that are very aware of this. So if we look at Google, for example, you know, there have been a couple of years ago, a big scandal with Google saying, well, we don't want to develop our AI for military use, and people resigning over that and protests. So there are kind of debates ongoing in the tech industry about what are the kind of ethical limits to what we do. At the same time, you know, technology is then going to be shaped by whoever uses it. So how much can we actually avoid that risk? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, presumably you can't be that specific when you're developing certain kinds of technology about whether it could be used for military purposes or not.
Yeah, I mean, this is where the regulation is going to need to come in as well, right? Because we need to decide, well, regulation in terms of as artificial intelligence develops, more like what are the kind of ethical limits on what we want that AI to actually be, but also, yeah, what technologies are going to be able to be used for military purposes. And this is where the kind of debate on the regulation of autonomous weapons comes in. But also, you know, the European Parliament, for example, has put forward many different kind of directives to say, well, actually, there are some technologies which should not be allowed for military use. So, you know, but many of these debates are still very much ongoing. We don't have set regulations, which is really concerning. And this is why it's such an important topic at the moment.
And do you think that, I mean, we're obviously in the context of an ongoing war in Ukraine and a lot of competition between the US and China. Do you think that we can reach some kind of reasonable consensus and agreement to prevent the proliferation of dangerous weapons? Do you think that's a likely thing?
That's a really difficult question to answer. Yeah, I mean, there have been a series of ongoing meetings for years in terms of how do we actually regulate these technologies. And I think that there have been quite a lot of developments. I think a consensus probably will be found eventually. I have hope of that. I guess my concern is whether that consensus is going to be kind of good enough in a way. So, you know, for example, say we say with autonomous weapons, we want to regulate them so that meaningful human control is actually present at all times. But the problem is then, well, how do we define meaningful human control? And this is where lawyers always come in, right? They use kind of clever definitions to actually argue for their side. You know, if we look at developments in existing technologies, if we look at air missile defense systems, for example, you know, these are kind of systems that are set up to, if there's an incoming kind of missile, well, okay, this is an enemy missile, we need to target it, you know, and then we'll actively kind of undertake that process. And humans are supposed to be watching over this system at all times and you know, making the final choice. They can stop the system if they say, well, no, actually, you shouldn't be targeting this. But there are various studies that show, well, actually, you know, the machines are so complicated now, and the decision time that humans actually have to oversee that is now so short, often as little as 6 seconds. Do we even have meaningful human control over the systems that already exist? And if that's the standard that we already have over these systems that are seen currently to be automated, not as autonomous, but if that's the existing standard, well, is that just going to be the standard that we see as meaningful human control going forward? So I think that there are kind of, we will probably come to some sort of agreement, but there are serious risks about it being far too weak, precisely because a lot of states do want these technologies as well. And that's part of the problem that we always face in international law. It's always based on state consent, but a lot of states often don't always want things that maybe the everyday person would.
Yeah, and it seems to mostly be the smaller states that probably couldn't themselves develop those technologies that are calling for the moratoria. And the large states like the US and China are more interested in actually developing themselves because they could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point. And if you look, all of the states that have called for a moratorium or for a ban of autonomous weapons, they're all based in the global south, bar the Holy See, which is a different thing and debatably, a bit of a different kind of context. But you know, I think that that's really, really important to note because, yeah, who's developing these technologies and who are they going to use them against as well? It's a really important power dynamic here.
And I just want to ask one final but very, very broad question. We might get into a bit of a discussion about this, but there's a lot of conversation about international law and kind of developing countries objecting to some elements of it because essentially a lot of it was written just after or just before the Second World War and they didn't have much say in writing it at all. And I just wonder what you think of that and whether you think that international law as it stands is kind of inherently also anti-feminist and like, do we need to tear the whole system down or are there kind of small changes we can make that can change that?
Yeah, that is a very big question, but kind of the question in some ways that I'm always trying to think about in my research. So I'd be interested to hear what you think as well. But yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, in international law, we call this TWAIL scholarship, third world approaches to international law. So it's this reclamation of the label third world really going on here. And international law was largely made by European states, you know, originally they held sovereignty. They were the only states that could make international law. And it's not even just kind of the 21st century international legal developments that were made without the consent of much of the global south. But if we look, there are kind of centuries old principles that we're still using in international law today that quite definitely were developed by Europe and nobody else. So I think that that's a really important thing to kind of note. And how could we can move forward from that is a really interesting question. And to just think about the kind of feminist elements as well, you know, to bring that in as also, I mean, international law was also largely made by men. You know, feminist approaches to international law didn't really kind of kick off so much until sort of early 90s. And that's pretty late in the game, really, when you think about it. So it is also very much a gendered structure. If we look at international human rights law, there are kind of lots of critiques that have shown that international human rights law was designed with the needs of men in mind initially. So how we kind of move forward from that, I think it is really challenging. But I think, again, as an international lawyer, someone who's trained in international law, I see my role very much as being how can we use these structures and use the kind of skills and expertise that I and my colleagues have to try and change it from within. But there's always this important question of, well, how do we also reimagine a world beyond international law itself? But if it's such a problematic structure, there's also that need for an imaginary beyond. So that's kind of the way I see it, and trying to hold those two things together, which sometimes don't fit together very well, but it's important to note those contradictions too. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think about this question?
Well, I was just interested. You said you were looking for, you're trying to see ways within it to change the system. So you do think there are decent mechanisms within the system to actually change it?
I guess decent mechanisms, it's difficult, isn't it? I think that there are mechanisms that can be used in various different ways. I mean, as I said before, being a lawyer is often about kind of interpreting things in different ways. So I think, you know, and if we can look at the ways that feminists, for example, have already done so much work in international law to make it fit women's needs much more. So in international human rights law in particular, you know, we now have like this whole wealth of kind of women's rights bodies and literature, etc. So I think that there is scope for that, definitely. And there have been some really positive changes. At the same time, you know, power dynamics very much persist, particularly in terms of the global north and south, but also in terms of gender as well. And there's a limit to how far I think you can transform the system within. So that's a kind of constant tension, I think. You know, if you want to kind of work on the ground and actually change reality, well, you end up having to kind of work with these problematic structures, and you can get some good things, but it's always going to be inherently limited. And that's why I think there's a need to also kind of look at those imaginations beyond. And there's a place for kind of both elements of that work, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I guess the elephant in the room is those people that argue that international law is all just a cover for what's essentially just power in the international arena, and without the support of powerful countries, not very much gets done.
Yeah, and I think that is broadly correct. International law, for me, I'm very much in the kind of critical school of international law, and following people like Marty Koskinevi, etc. International law for me is ultimately politics. It's a kind of particularly technical tool that people use to make political arguments. And yeah, in the end, what happens is largely what powerful states want to happen. And I think there's a constant need to pay attention to that and to assess that, and to recognize that international law is not kind of, as it proclaims to be, this very kind of equal structure for everybody to participate in the same way, because that's just not the reality.
Yeah, no, I was interested when you said this idea of like a lot of these rules and norms have been around for centuries. I was thinking how we're talking about like the Westphalian state system as kind of the very, very basic kind of unit of international law. that really has been around for centuries, although the Chinese like to say that the Europeans don't respect it very well, which is also quite ironic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and kind of interesting the ways in which I think, you know, global South states or other kind of entities that weren't part of that European base at the start of international law in many ways use these different principles in different ways. You know, sovereignty was very much created by Europe, and it was originally to exclude global South states from being able to actually have a voice in international law. Well, you're not a sovereign state because you're not civilized enough, in inverted commas, of course. But, you know, at the same time, sovereignty right now for many global South states is vitally important, because if you don't have sovereignty, well, that just means that, you know, countries such as the UK, such as the US, can probably just invade you if they want to. So we need to kind of, I think it's interesting the ways in which global South states in particular are really kind of taking ownership in international law and using it in ways to protect their interests. And I think that focus on the agency of those states is also a really important part of the debate here.
It's been such an interesting conversation. Thanks so much for speaking to me, Emily.
No worries, I've really enjoyed it. And thanks again for inviting me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Ethics for a Changing World. Be sure to share this episode with anyone you might be interested, and to leave us a review on Apple Podcast or subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. We have lots of other episodes that you might be interested in, particular our most recent episode on transhumanism. And we also have the first episode that we did was specifically on the regulation of lethal autonomous weapon systems, which we discuss a little bit in this episode. So if you'd like a whole episode on that topic, then give it a listen. Be sure to let us know on Twitter at EthicsTechPod or on Instagram at Ethics for a Changing World what you thought of this episode. I'll see you again next time.